Good evening, everybody, and I hope you've had a nice retreat so far. My name is Ajahn Apu. I've been in the monastery for the last 3 years. I was one of Ajahn Brom's first group of monks that he ordained. So I'm getting on a bit. Okay, so we'll give it a whirl and see what we've got. Dear Venerable Sir, is say to be in and out of jhana or up and down from the jhana? Is jhana within the body or outside the body? Thank you. So with the process of the jhana meditation, say moving into the samadhi state, the personal experience of the practitioner is as you develop the meditation and you, say, withdraw in from the five senses, you're moving into the mind. The actual process, your actual sensory experience, the way they explain it, is you're actually drawn into the samadhi state. So the more, as you develop your meditation and the thinking process starts to, like, fade away in a major way and you're moving towards the point where the thought process is shutting down, you're moving into the mind element, and then the person has the bliss and the light which accompanies that samadhi state. So it actually draws you in, and then the person has the experience of, say, like moving into the base. You know, you're moving into the mind, but it's the sense of withdrawing from the five senses. So that sense of going into the mind, and the experiences that you absorb into like the mind element, so you're fully withdrawn from the body and its five senses. So I hope some of you tasted that on this retreat. It's a hard one to do. So, dear Venerable, after getting the bright nimittas, we should let go. When we let go, do we focus on the nimitta? Thanks. So for those of you who are able to get a nimitta up, which is the first, sign of the pure mind. So as soon as you reach reach the periphery of the pure mind, that the nimitta is the first indication that you have the pure mind in the reflection of the pure mind within the mind's eye. If the nimitta is very quite, say, weak or dull, and it's actually inconsistent, you know, you're not getting, say, a fully sustained nimitta, that the person they've got to stay with the breath and sustain their attention on the breath until the nimitta is quite pronounced and it's stable and it's bright and it reaches the point where actually it draws you into the mind. Into the mind element, because the breath meditation is the bridge from the beginning stage to the samadhi nimitta, and when the nimitta is strong, then the nimitta takes you all the way in through upachara samadhi and then into the jhana state. So, you know, you've got to use that sort of like that bridging principle to take you all the way into the base of the first jhana. So, dear Ajahn, I notice certain sounds can create nice glowing lights during meditation. For example, the bowl sounding at the end of the meditative session. Would you recommend playing a recording of intermittent sounds while meditating at home? So it depends on the individual. Some people might find, say spiritual music or soundtracks, it might help to sort of calm and make them feel tranquil. But realistically, you know, when you're talking about quite like deep meditation, that you reach a point, you know, once you become really calm, you know, you're looking at an experience where, you know, you've got your five sensory withdrawal. You know, you're withdrawing in from the body and its five senses, moving into the mind element. And your ability to hear, you've actually got to withdraw from that. You've got to detach from that and move inwards. So if you find from the beginning to the intermediate stage that it's helpful for you, it helps you to focus in the present moment, and it supports the process of the meditation, say in the first 50% of one's practice, that'd be all well and good, but you'd have to let the sound, no matter how, say, beautiful and melodious it is, you've got to let it go at some point in order to, even before to sustain a samadhi nimitta, essentially you've got to let go of the five senses virtually completely. It's very, very close at that point to get a full samadhi nimitta experience with full energy. That you've got to be very, almost fully withdrawn from the body. And especially people who've got mastery, they tend to see that earlier than people who maybe fluke it. So, dear Achan, would you kindly share with us the significance of the Katina ceremony? Thank you. So, with the Katina ceremony, the Katina ceremony is the formal celebration of the community, or say the monastic community, who've actually completed the rains retreat. So, say for example with the bhikkhunis or the monks who've actually done the 3 months meditation retreat, then those community members are actually eligible to participate in the Katina ceremony. So the Katina ceremony involves the acceptance and the cutting and the stitching of the Katina cloth, which is offered by the lay community who've actually supported the monastics at that time. So with regardless of the temple, you usually find it's the close disciples who actually organise the offering of the Katina cloth. So it's the cloth is actually offered in recognition of the monastics who've actually completed the rains retreat, and then the cloth will be sewn up into a lower robe or the full robe. So the lower robe is actually less work than the thin robe I've got on top here. And it's usually the one that's done because if there's any, say, any obstacles or any problems or whatnot, I mean, sometimes you can be going till, say, like midnight, from, say, mid-afternoon till midnight if there's any complications. But if you've got somebody who's really very, very fast with especially with the stitching, you can usually wrap it up maybe around, you're going all afternoon, and maybe you can finish it maybe 7 p.m. at the very earliest. So it does take quite a while. And then the Katina robe, the community members, they actually designate the person who's actually eligible to accept the robe at the ceremony, the Katina ceremony, which is celebrated that 1 week on the Sunday. So on the Sunday, the robe will actually be offered at the festival, on the festival day here. The significance is I've never checked the Pali translation, but it's the bestowing of the cloth on a specific member who's actually elected, who's actually who's been elected by the community. So you're looking at the full process, the full community who've actually completed the rains retreat without break, and then the cloth is actually bestowed on an elected member, in the community. So when we at the last, earlier than that, we'd already made a decision that the cloth was going to be given to a particular individual. Yeah, it's a combination. For example, on the Katina day on Sunday, it involves the celebration with the lay community. So it involves the teachings, the precepts, the chanting, all the activities which are meant for the lay disciples, and then the monastics have their part in the Katina ceremony, with the formal occasion, with the offering of the cloth and then the chanting for the Katina and then the blessing. So for the Katina day, you have the participation and the organisation with the lay community members, and then the monastics do their bit on the day as well. So you're looking at a full community engagement. It's not just the monastics and the offering of the cloth. It's everybody. So, dear Venerable, when I experience colour, space of rainbow during meditation, is this nimitta? So, especially in the meditation process, people can have all sorts of very strange experiences and lights, tastes and sounds, and some very very encouraging, interesting experiences on the mental level. But to be, a true nimitta, which is a mind experience. It's a pure mind experience. So the nimitta is the first indication you're actually moving into the mind element, and it's something that you're quite quite sure of. It's not, you don't have any confusion or doubt, with that sort of deep meditation. So with the It is possible for people to have nimittas which may be slightly different colour, but the reason why the person has the white nimitta, the purity of the white nimitta, is because you've got the suppression of the five hindrances, and because of the purity of the mind, that's why you get the purity of the light. You get instead of having a dull, say, grey light, or maybe a very pale blue, hazy kind of presentation. You're looking at high energy. You're looking at purity. You're looking at piti sukha. You're looking at stability with the nimitta presentation. So when it's there and it's sustained, the vast majority of people it's very bright and it's white in nature. But at the initial stages, it is possible you can have like pale, you could have like very pale grey or pale blue or even like pink. People have described those experiences previously, but that will be at the very initial stages. It won't be at the point where you've got the nimitta. I've hardly ever heard that, even over say the last 16, 17 years, of a person who had a sustained nimitta where you're looking at like bright pink or maybe bright yellow. I've never heard of that kind of experience previously. Dear Venerable, can you explain the concept of transferring merits? So with the transfer of demerits that we undertake, what we're actually doing there is the merits that we've actually say performed or undertaken at a particular occasion, or maybe even say in the distant past, because every time you've performed an act of merit or positive karma, that intention is actually stored on a deeper level in the mind, because all the karma that you've actually created in the past, all the good karma, the bad karma, the neutral, it's all stored on a deeper level in the mind. You know, it's like so this is why, for example, on the spiritual path, that you know, we have this incredible accumulation of past karma, over millions and millions of lives, you know, as the Buddha said in the sutta, from the a beginningless point, that we don't see a beginning point with the rebirth process. So your karma just extends right back into to the endless past. And so with this transfer of merits, that we may choose a particular individual. It could be a friend who's in trouble, or say a friend who's passed away, and we're not sure of maybe the quality of the rebirth, and or we may want to make, if you want to maximize your personal merit, we make say a full dedication to both all say unfortunate beings and all beings in samsara. And because when you go out to the full range, you maximize your own say like personal karma. So, when you take it out to its maximum limit, so the transfer of merits, when it comes say down to the reality principle, the beings who are able to actually make use of the merit that you dedicate for them, and these particular beings are the ones who can benefit directly from this transfer of merit in the present moment. They are a class of beings, in the Pataloka, where one class of four beings in the Pataloka who are dependent on the dedication of merit that people actually make for them. So they're able to actually use that merit to both not only increase their personal happiness, but actually on a high point to raise them to a higher point, say in the rebirth process. So they can receive that merit and get the benefit from that merit in different ways, but ultimately it has the an ability to raise up, to improve the the happiness within the mind, to reduce the the hunger and thirst and the their personal torment to a degree, because the Pataloka, these are states of like deprivation. You're looking at experiences of say hunger, cold, heat, painful feelings, bodily, bodily discomfort, the kind of coarse physical body that they have in the lower realms. So, dear Achan, I am given to understand that Buddhists are not encouraged to complain or criticize or comment on anything because this is your reaction to that something. What if it is a rule or a request that is broken? Isn't it justified? Please enlighten me. It seems to me that the complainant is the wrongdoer, while the doer, the one that breaks the rule, is right. Thank you. Yeah, well, it's true. I mean, you know, people, they're entitled to their personal, say, views and opinions on issues. But, you know, like it cuts, you know, it does cut both ways. So, you know, if a particular individual, you know, like criticises you, I mean, they might be quite justified. But, you know, they've got to, you know, the way the Buddha explained it, that, you know, you've got to be together yourself before you start sort of pointing the finger at other people. You know, so you look at yourself first. You know, am I an individual who actually practices, you know, with purity, in body, speech, and mind? You know, when I admonish that person, am I coming from a heart of loving kindness and maybe not a heart of say hatred or aversion or say ego? And you know, do I have that person's you know, like welfare in mind? And so that, you know, they're the major principles. You know, you look at yourself. You know, are you actually coming from a good position, a good perspective, good attitude? And you know, you speak with kindness, you speak with facts, and you know, the consideration is for the, you know, say the welfare and benefit of the person. Because in my position, I mean, I could jump on people on a regular basis. I mean, I could do it every single day if I chose to. But the kind of attitude I have, because I'm sitting in the second seat, and you know, when Ajahn Brahm goes overseas, I'll be at the top of the line. But I'm quite careful with this one, because if I start jumping on other people, you know, other people will start jumping on me. So, you know, it cuts both ways. And so, you know, but the thing is, the kind of, you know, if you have to approach a person with the monastics, what we do, you ask permission. You ask the person, you know, do you mind if I talk to you about a particular issue or problem or whatnot? So you ask for leave to actually to speak or to admonish. And then when you come across, you know, you just come across with kindness and welfare in mind. But, you know, even though you may follow the correct principles, it doesn't mean that that person, whether it's a lay person or monastic, is going to be, you know, sort of, you know, so joyfully accepting of your benevolence. So, you know, you've got to be very, you know, you've got to be quite careful with this one. But, you know, maybe sometimes you don't, you know, have any choice. But the thing is with this business that, you know, it's still that same thing. You know, they may catch you out. I mean, I can jump on people quite easily, but they could catch me out maybe in another 2, 3, 4 weeks. You know, it's So, dear Ajahn, when your ears feel blocked and you start to feel as if something is sitting on your head, what is happening and what should you do next? So, yeah, it's an unusual one. So, when your ears feel blocked and you start to feel as if something is sitting on your head. Yeah, I mean, each, you know, especially with the meditators, I mean, that with the monastics, especially the first 5 years, people have all sorts of different sensory experiences. So, especially with the lay disciples, I'd say easily the first 10 years you can have some really unusual, quite interesting sensory experiences affecting both your body and your mind. And The person, the kind of attitude I'd have with this one is to be aware of it. Maybe a good idea is to actually contemplate it, just reflect on it, maybe for a short period of time. And then as long as it doesn't actually block the course of the meditation, because you find that, sometimes you can get this strange phenomena coming up, but you've got like underlying, say, defilements or energies behind it, which may be distracting the person, which may be sort of taking you away from your meditation object, because the mind in itself, if you're reaching a stage where the mind is calming down, and you're getting a good level of practice going, this may be one of the maybe you need the last point where the underlying, say, defilements or these energies in the mind try to sort of lead you away. But my attitude would be is if it doesn't go away, like reflect on it, in a very, very full way, and just watch it, watch it closely, see if it settles down, and if it doesn't settle down, what I would do is I'd switch over to a mantra formation. You basically want to reduce the power of this state. If it's a distraction, it's blocking you from going deeper in the meditation. I do things like this particular experience. Identify the experience, whatever it is say changeable or empty in nature. You will see at least a small degree of detachment when you do a general investigation, because you can't neglect this one, because you're going to get blocked time and time again with the meditation process. And as something comes up and it doesn't go away, 10, 15 minutes later, it's still there, and it's irritating you, and it won't settle down. So just investigate it in a regular fashion, from all perspectives, and then if it doesn't go, if it still persists, then I'd use this mantra format to reduce the forcefulness, the power that actually has over you. It's a nice big one. So, dear Bhante, this sums up Achan Brahm to me in verse 58-59 in the Dhammapada. Just as a sweet-smelling and beautiful lotus can grow from a pile of discarded waste, the radiance of a true disciple of the Buddha outshines dark shadows cast by ignorance, or as in a pile of rubbish cast by the side of a highway, a lotus may grow clean, smelling, pleasing the heart. So in the midst of the rubbish, like run-of-the-mill and blind people, there dazzles with discernment the disciple of the rightly self-awakened one. Thank you, Venerable Achan Brahm, for a wonderful retreat. And thank you to all my fellow meditators. Be well and happy. Wonderful. So, dear Achan, I have constant whining in my ears. What should I do? It's disturbing me a lot. So, especially when the person's meditation starts to settle down, they get that naga, that nada sound that the Hindu practitioners actually use as a meditation object. It's usually in the right ear, the right side of the brain, and so you get this is a practice that Longpo Samedo in Amaravati in England has used quite skillfully over the years. And I was talking with one of the junior Achans there who was not silly by any degree, who'd been practicing in Thailand for absolute minimum like 8 years, and he'd actually practiced with enlightened monks, so he knew what he was talking about. But Longpo Sumedho had actually used that as a vehicle into samadhi, into very, very solid samadhi. So it is possible, even though it's a sound which arises in the, in the mind, so the mind brain connection, you can still develop that as a skill, because it really stands out. Like even for myself, it's just there constantly, and when I pay attention to it, so it's something that you can possibly focus on and use it as a skill. For some people, it may work well. For some people, they may not actually, find it that conducive. So, you can experiment with it and see how it goes. This kind of principle, you can relate it as well to the chan practice, where the person actually focuses on sound in their environment. So, for example, people can use very, very spacious mantra formulation when they're at work, when they're in the garden, when they're doing stuff around the house, and whatnot. You can do there's all sorts of things that you can focus on the sound element. You can use that very, very spacious vipassana practice, where you use the Burmese labeling method, but you only do it, you don't do it like every couple of seconds or with sustained attention. Maybe you do it every like 10, 15 seconds, but you can still get some samadhi. If you do that 10, 12, 14 hours a day, maybe only every, you do it in a very, very safe range, so you can function, you can actually drive, you could use a chainsaw, quite safely. This is the test. So, but when you do it, all day and half the night, you can get really good results, And for many of you, you've got the kind of mindset where you're basically Dhamma practitioners, and you're not playing around. You're doing your regular retreats. You're trying to sustain your practice on a day-to-day basis. This is something I'd recommend that people do, but keep yourself in a comfortable range, because if you're doing this all day, and you're doing it every day, it's an incredible amount of practice. And it's like you've got that behind you before it comes time for you to leave this life, and it'd be very, very powerful for you. So constant whining in the ears, what should I do? It's disturbing me a lot. Like for me, it basically doesn't, even though it's always there, it doesn't bother me whatsoever. But you can experiment with it. Just like listen to it for 5 minutes. Just get used to it. Don't try and push it away. Don't try and ignore it. Just gently put your attention on it, and just ask yourself, why is it bothering me? It's I've got this ringing, constant ringing in the ears. Why is it a problem? For me, I'm just constant. I'm just used to it. And just examine it. Why do I have a sense of irritation, aversion? Because you need to explore this. Otherwise, the problem it just won't go away. And try focusing on it. You can even do things like radiating loving kindness towards it or compassion towards it if you feel aversion. Just experiment. There's a couple of little tricks there. You can do things like, this sensory object is changeable and empty in nature. Just use this very spacious mantra format. Reduce the value, the importance of it. There's a couple of things you can do to reduce the effect of it. So, dear Bhante, if one loses direction in life, what should I tell them? If one loses, one loses its direction in life, what should I tell them? So, I'd imagine maybe a person. Is that correct? Another person loses their direction in life? Yes? No? Yes, okay. I'll just assume it is. So, I mean, what I would do is, you know, essentially you've got to give the person a degree of emotional support. And, you know, so one of the quick fix methods for a person who's really in trouble, you know, maybe despondent, depressed, you know, they're losing their will to live. You know, they feel they're hopeless. Their personal family relationships are just falling apart. They feel worthless as a person. You know, they're just going downhill. Just a very, very, say, quick fix method just to basically protect them, keep their head above the water, is get them to do the loving kindness meditation, loving kindness compassion mantra for themselves, you know, and, you know, to do it consistently. So, for example, because what's happening there is the person, they've got this emotional thought process running, which is basically it's taking them down. So the way the person's thinking, it's taking them down and out. So you want to maximize the positivity, the positive energy in the mind. So you use the loving kindness and compassion to bring the mind into balance. And if possible, you can do this kind of mantra in a spacious way. But if the person's really in trouble, you want to maximize the sustained attention, the peacefulness in the mind. So you do it. They do it continually, even if they chant it, or they do it mentally. So just very, very relaxed, and then maybe slowly, just do it continually and maximize the strength of the samadhi, the peacefulness. Because as soon as you settle, you know, that unskillful thought process, the person will start to feel better. Because essentially when a person is running into, there could be a biochemical imbalance. There could be, you know, problems in the family. It's not cut and dry. There could be a psychiatric disturbance, like paranoia, like depression. There could be other issues, other things happening as well. But if you're looking at a quick fix, just something, you know, something to protect us and, you know, just to cover them, sort of in the interim, you know, because that person could have a genuine medical condition. So, you know, you just try to keep their head above the water and just watch over them. And things like, say for example, the person, say, perks up a little, you know, with these positive meditations. And you know, the similar principle as well with the anicca perception, the emptiness perception. So they're zeroing in on the troublesome feeling, the negative feeling, the painful experience, and, you know, an easy one is that particular experience is empty in nature. I sort of say this kind of thing on a regular basis, but it's just one little tool that you can use among maybe half a dozen. You want to reduce the power of that obstructive state, and, you know, reduce its importance. And if the person, something that helps as well is for the individual, once they start to possibly get back on track and they start to feel a bit better about themselves, you know, encourage them to actually maybe help out with some charity work, you know, maybe helping out with say disadvantaged children, or helping out at a workshop for disadvantaged kids, maybe even things like a soup kitchen, you know, like a where you've got homeless people and troubled people, and, you know, they're the person who works behind the counter, and, you know, they're helping to get the foodstuffs together, and actually they're actually serving, giving out say bread and soup and foodstuffs for you know, poverty stricken people, for street people. Because this principle, you know, when you do something good for others, when you are of service for others, it actually gives rise to a sense of of at least a small degree of joy and happiness in the mind. It's a natural law within the mind that when you do something good for other people, when you're generous, when you're caring, when you have good intentions and help other people, that you get this little seed of happiness, inside you. And, it grows, as the days and weeks go by, it grows in the mind and you feel good about yourself because, selfish people who don't care, who don't give a stuff about others, you usually find that, if you look at the exterior, they may be quite shallow people. They may give you the impression that they're quite happy. I'll just see if I can maybe increase the loudness of this. No, maybe not. So for people who are quite, maybe they might be doing well in life, they might be quite successful, and give you the impression that they're quite happy. But when you see beyond the veneer, that's not really necessarily the case, because the people who have real happiness in life, it's a heart-based quality, and it's a principle which is actually connected with. Say wholesome intentions, wholesome actions. The kind of veneer, especially people who've got money, they've got big money and they've got nice possessions, they've got a nice partner. That person, you can see a veneer of happiness. This is happiness. This kind of happiness, which is dependent on external things, but when you're talking about maybe like real happiness on the heart level, it's got to come from something which is a bit deeper than that, which is actually connected with Dharma principles, more subtle things. And it's all well and good to have to have money and nice things and a nice partner and whatnot, but sometimes it's just not enough. Dear Archan, last night after meditation, I feel, say, the person felt a headache. I fly too high? Please advise. Thank you. Exalted state of mind. So last night after meditation, I felt a headache, a strong headache. Is it because I fly too high? the impression I get is maybe the person is maybe aiming too high in the meditation. I mean, you've got to correct me if I don't get this clearly. Is that the case? What? Is that a joke, is it? Okay. You guys probably understand each other a lot better than I understand. Oh, what, fly through the air? Oh, God. You lucky, lucky devil. Okay, so, dear Archan, if I need to give a talk on Buddhism and I have only 2 days to prepare, which sutta shall I read beside the Wikipedia and why? The kind of attitude I would have, I could do it like It depends what kind of audience. I mean, if you want to be, if you basically want to get it down pat and make sure it's up to scratch, I'd you've got to have some preparation. So this person's got 2 days. So I would focus. I'd definitely focus on a sutta which really takes your fancy. You know, that you really feel some connection with. Because if you've got whatever piece, whatever sutta that you're working with, if you're interested in it, and you can comprehend it at least to a small degree, just straight off the cuff, you've got a better chance of actually giving a reasonable, presentation. If say for example you chose a sutta that you it's just common sense that you didn't like, and it made absolutely no sense to you whatsoever, that you might find that your audience would actually sense that. And so if because if you like the sutta, you can comprehend it at least to a small degree, you feel confident, feel positive, it'll tend to come out, that the format will be much more effective. And number two, do you think we need to know Pali to chant better? Why can't all chanting be in English? Thank you. So, the Pali was the original, was as close to the original language that the Buddha spoke. So the Buddha spoke the provincial language of, say, Magadhes, which is as close to the Buddha's original language as the actual Pali is as close to Magadhes as you can get. So in formal situations, especially the monastics tend to chant Pali on a regular basis, because this is the standard chanting language format that we do in all monasteries all over the world. But there's no reason why you can't chant in, say, Sri Lankan or Burmese or Vietnamese. You know, regardless of the tradition, the country, the time and place, if you chant in your native language, you may find it more effective. You know, you can comprehend it completely. It makes sense to you. So there's no reason why you can't chant in your native language. And but you find that even when you chant the Pali, even though if you can't comprehend it, that the effect of it will be I mean, you will still get a very, very similar effect that when you actually chant it in your own language. So for example, you chant the Metta Sutta in Pali, and you get the effect of the loving kindness. You do any of the compassion, the equanimity, any kind of, say, perception. If you try to manipulate the mind using, say, Pali language in any kind of with any tools, any format within practice, you will actually get the effect, the same effect when you use your own language. It may be more effective for you. Because the thing is that the Pali is as close as you can get to the original language, the original dialect of the Buddha. And because many of you would have known Pali in the past. You virtually all of you have got a Dharma connection, and you can almost guarantee that you would have known at least a small degree of Pali in the past, because you're going back into absolutely thousands and thousands of past existences. But you may find it much more effective and more meaningful for yourself. I wouldn't be surprised as well that you'd probably have many of the language the language translations on the internet, which would make it a bit easier for you. Dear Achan, today is the second last day of retreat. I saw people who, with sad and troubled face on our first day, now I saw the smile on their face. I'm very happy and for them, although I don't know them. So it's like sympathetic joy. you're definitely working it. Even I come in different mind. Many of us bring back happiness, not, say, 23 kilograms for Qantas. I just get to know you. I love you from the first sight today. I have a chance to get so close to you. I love your kindness. I love your smile. I love your teaching. Again, I wish you to stay healthy, strong, and long, long life. Your Majesty Achan, please grant us to have a safe journey home again. I don't want to die now. till we meet again. I love you always. I'll be more than happy to share your deep feelings with Achan Brom when I see him tomorrow morning. Yeah, but I mean, you know, Achan Brom's, you know, he's had people come up to him who, you know, who've told him that they were right on the edge and he saved their life. You know, if he hadn't been there at that time, they would have killed themselves. So it was really, really serious. Dear Achan, if I have time left in this world to read and understand only one sutta, which one would you recommend? In English translation, and why? Oh, let's see. Oh, let me think now. Yeah, I mean, I would go for the core suttas, the ones where, say, for example, things like, you know, the really meaty stuff, like, say, the discourses that the Buddha recited at key points, during his, after he attained, say, enlightenment, say like the fire sermon, when he actually set forth the wheel of Dhamma, when he taught the first five disciples. So, you're looking at the fire sermon, the Anatana Lakana Sutta, zero in, go for those key suttas, that were at those key moments in the Buddha's teaching career. And those ones have a lot of significance to them. And even, like, for example, they will use these when, especially like with the monastics, and say, for example, key lay disciples, when they're on their deathbeds, they will zero in and they will do the full repertoire. So right through the key moments in the Buddha's 45-year teaching career, they will go right through the full spectrum and they will recite all those suttas and those key discourses for the person, when they're on their deathbed. So the reason why is because those suttas, they are quite powerful. They are key teachings. They are profound teachings. And what's happening is, as that person, if the person was sick, they were dying, they were incredibly troubled, that you're infusing their mind, at least to a small degree, you know, with the power of the sutta, the understanding of the sutta, even though it may be in Pali language. So for example, they're a Western person, you do it in Pali, you will still get an effect of it, because it's the Buddha's, you know, it's the Buddha's words, and you know, which have, you know, which carry, you know, which have a lot of say Dhamma power. So you know, you're putting those teachings actually into the mind of that person, you're reconditioning the mind of that person, and you're establishing path principles and major teachings and guide points in the mind. So you know, if the person, especially the person who's dying, you know, you are setting the mind up, I mean, at least to a small intermediate degree, in the, you know, with, especially, you know, you're supporting the rebirth process, a conducive rebirth, you know, for the that individual. So how did you become a monk, and what inspired you? I can only talk, you know, as you know, most of you are very aware, or may be fully aware of Achyam Brahm's personal history. So with myself, so what happened from a young age, I started to get into, say, Buddhism, like Zen Buddhism, from age 15, and I was reading books on, say, both Zen and Chan Buddhism, and reading the stories and the parables of the enlightened masters. And even at that point, you know, just even reading, say, books by Alan Watts and D.T. Suzuki, and, say, major, say, Chinese, Japanese, Western authors. That I just found it just really quite fascinating. And so I did this for a number of years, like several years. And then I heard about the Thai monastery up at Bundanoon, you know, just down the road from Achan Sujato's place. His Western-based monastery. And so I went up and I was practicing with the monks there, like on and off, from say roughly mid 20s. Right, yeah. It would have been like say mid, yeah. At the latest, mid 20s, right through, say 25, at the latest, right through to before, you know, like my late, say, like 20, yeah, coming up before my 30th birthday. So I was going back and forth to Sunataram. I was working, you know, I was doing a bit of contract engineering and doing, you know, a few odd jobs, and I was traveling overseas and whatnot, but I just kept going back to the monastery, and I was doing personal retreats for a week or 2 weeks at a time between these work episodes. But I just reached a point where I just made the... But what actually happened there as well, from the... the engineering side, from, you know, I was at the steelworks doing an apprenticeship from age 15 to 19, and then I did a diploma in applied science and become a registered nurse. So that was like 3 years, and then 2 years in the hospital system. But I was meditating and studying Dhamma right through this point. And then I just reached a decision where I just had to stop work completely. And then I decided to come to Perth for my monk's training, because the Western community here was better established. The building work was much more developed. You know, you had teachers who could speak fluent English. The weather was much warmer, so I thought it was, the conditions here were much more conducive for the first 5 to 7 years of my monk's practice. So, and I came here and I stayed with Achyam Brahm, and you know, I mean, I found him a very, very good teacher. He's basically, you know, within the Western, you know, I mean, I mean, across the board, really, because I mean, I've had contact with quite a number of Western teachers, and I've spent time with, say, enlightened teachers in Thailand. But you know, I mean, essentially, he's got more ability to teach meditation and Dhamma than, I mean, really, the vast majority of teachers that I've actually come across. And for me, you know, he's definitely the best teacher I've spent time with. And he understands Western is very good. You know, he understands the process of meditation. I mean, people, you know, the ability to teach in different ways. So, for example, with the Thai monks, the Burmese, the Sri Lankan, they may have a slightly more rigid format, maybe not so flexible. You know, I mean, any teacher that you see has got a minimum degree of flexibility. That, you know, they've got experience. They can teach in different ways. They've got a certain range of personal meditative experience. But yeah, so you know, you'll find that maybe you may find that even with Western people, they may find a Burmese teacher who really, you know, is the best teacher they've found and will continue to be. So you know, it's very much a personal experience. But as far as inspiration goes, that on an ultimate level, it's that this ability, you know, the possibility of actually getting enlightened at some point in the future. I mean, otherwise I wouldn't waste my time, like doing this. You know, because this practice, it takes, you know, you've got to have, a lot of patience. You know, you're doing this day after day after day, you know, for years on end. And, you know, you've got to keep, you know, sharpening the practice. You're swapping, changing, you're making adjustments. So the people who basically last in the long term are the ones who know how to work, especially, you know, work with the meditation. They're interested, you know, they're very patient. They know, you know, they're looking at a lifetime's work, minimum 20, 30, 40 years. You know, they're with a good community. You know, they can, the teacher, they've got a good connection with the teacher. They've got enough happiness, personal happiness, enough insight to keep them going, because the people who fall away, not necessarily through any fault of their own, because there's multiple reasons why people lose inspiration, lose faith and go back, you know, easily. It could be like half a dozen. But one of the key principles is it's the quality of the meditation and the level of, say, peacefulness in the mind. The bottom line is it's the underlying defilements in the mind, these obstacles that we have on the spiritual path. If you want to get down to tin tacks, this is what takes people out of monastic life, or this is what damages, say, the practice of the lay disciple, maybe slows them down to a major degree, discourages them, you know, makes it difficult. So essentially, you know, if you know how to work with these energies, and you can basically keep the finger on them, you can go a long way in the Dhamma practice, because essentially that's what you're going to be working with. You know, you're going to have your happiness and joy. You know, you're going to have your insight, your wisdom. You're going to have your full range of personal experiences. Very, very encouraging, very, maybe like profound, meditative experiences, fantastic retreats. So, you know, you're going to go the full range. You're going to have your despair, your anger, your irritation. But the bottom line is, you know, you look at yourself very, very carefully, and you try to keep your practice in balance, and look at the big picture. You know, you're not You know, try to be as skillful as you can, and you know, go for good quality meditation on a day-to-day basis. I mean, for me, that's the way I teach. I don't teach jhana practice. I don't have the jhanas, so I don't teach the jhanas to lay disciples. You know, Ajahn Brahm is very very skillful in that area, so you know, he's got the authority, you know, to teach on the, you know, from the heart level. I saw colours, different colours, so it is like tunnel light. Is this it? So, well, it's definitely something. It's not to, you know, not to be sniffed at. So with this this business with colours, so like many of you, you're going to get like alterations in perceptions. You're going to get different energies in the mind. You're going to get colours, lights, you know, different sensory kind of experiences. But if you're looking at the bottom line, if you want to know without any doubt whether it's the real thing or whether it's just a temporary, an interesting but temporary experience, is the common factors. So for example, you're getting a very good state of meditation. The way a really good samadhi, samatha vipassana teacher would describe it is, you know, you're looking at, I mean, significant five sensory withdrawal where the mind is starting to shut down. You know, you've got a state of mind which is very energetic, it's bright, it's really sharp. It's like a laser beam. You know, you can feel yourself being drawn in to the mind element. The bliss is very, very strong. The sense of solidity, the state, it's as solid as a rock. You know, there's nothing like you know, you don't get distracted if you're sitting quietly. You don't get distracted by, you know, like small noises or this type of thing. It's a very, very you know, it's a profound state. So, and then, you know, you're getting this sense of like moving in, the sensory withdrawal, and I mean, incredibly deep peace and contentment. So, you know, they are the major factors or the signposts. So that will give you an idea if it's the real thing or if it's just another interesting experience that you're actually passing through as you're moving like deeper into you know, your mind experience. So, dear Ajahn, please help convey my thanks to Michelle, Dania, and all the other helpers. It has been a wonderful retreat, sadhu, three times over. It's fantastic to hear. What happens after you die? What is the process of rebirth? Okay, so what happens when you die? So, the person, they'll say the last couple of moments before your consciousness actually leaves this physical body. The person, what can happen with many people is they have this, what they call the death proximate nimitta. This is the karma nimitta that you have in the last moments in this death sequence. You know, it could be the last, say, several thought moments. Like, I don't study Abhidharma, but those the last stage, you know, those last couple of thought moments in the death process, and you can get, say, depending on the quality of your personal karma, your good and bad karma, you will get a nimitta. You could get a couple of, say, maybe memories of significant events in your life. It could be things like the days when you made incredible maybe merit in the monastery, or days when you ripped somebody off, or you stole their husband or their wife. So, you know, really, you know, key important events in your life in relation with your personal karma, good and bad karma, could flash up. And then the death proximate nimitta, that's the big one. That one will be the last one which will determine where you will go, where you will be reborn. And so you're looking at this conditioning process right up to the last point, the death proximate nimitta. You know, you're looking at this, you know, the which way the mind's going to go, you know, the force of the karma. If it's largely wholesome, if your karma is largely wholesome right up to the last stage, the death proximate nimitta will be wholesome, and it will take you to a good rebirth. So, and it will be instantaneous. There will be no breaks. So as your mind, you know, because it's incredibly fast, as your mind leaves this physical body, there's no it arises, the way the Buddha described it. It arises immediately in its new life, process of rebirth, which is activated for the next life. So dear Achanabi, can you please give some tips on how to live harmoniously in a community? Thanks heaps. Oh, that's a this is a good one. Because all of us, especially people who've been in the monastery for, I mean, nothing less than 3, 6, 12 months, you know, they're people, you know, they're very focused, they're genuine, you know, they're people who are really, you know, they're really interested in developing themselves. But, you know, when we're looking at the, or say initially and even the long term, the things that the kind of perspective I have with people in the community is for me, you know, because I'm at the top of the line on a regular say the second seat or the at the top of the line when Ajahn Brahm's out of the monastery. And, you know, essentially, I have to get along with people in my position. The junior monks, they can love and hate each other, if the mood takes them, you know, that it doesn't really matter so much. But being at the top of the line, it's much more tricky from my perspective. So, the kind of angle I come from is regardless of who they are, I make an effort to get along with them. And even if that person doesn't particularly like me, or they don't like the way I teach, or they don't like my personality, or there's some underlying karma, or this or that, I still make an effort. Because eventually, once they get to know you, once you get to know them, you can facilitate at least a small connection. Because the community that we have here, it's very easygoing, it's very, very spacious. We have many different types of people with different personalities, but, you know, the community we have here, we've got room for like everybody, you know, no matter sort of how wonderful or how unusual they are. But the vast majority of the people we have here, they're virtually all of them, they're really good people. Once you get to know them, you actually see what they're made of, and they're made of good stuff. So, you know, they're worthy. You know, the Anagarikas and the lay disciples who stay in the monastery, they're fine people. You know, they are worthy of kindness. They are worthy of respect. You know, when I mix with people, you know, I tend to treat people, say, like, personally. I don't necessarily have to be their best friend, but I tend to have personal relationships with people in the community. And you know, things like, you know, the easiest way to connect with anybody is, you know, you find out what that person is interested in. And it's the easiest thing in the world to get talking with them and to foster some kind of connection. You know, it doesn't matter who they are, male, female, young or old. You know, you find out what they're interested in, you know, what they're really interested in, and you can hit it off much more easily. So other little other perspectives I come from as well is just, you know, just being, you know, doing things like, so for example, if I get, you know, if I get sort of like, you know, if I get stuff offered to me, or if I come by things, or something is actually offered to me personally, like things like, you know, like nice slabs of chocolate, you know, I actually share it with, you know, so for example, like if I come back from Nalamara, I actually put the really nice chocolate, and I actually give it to Achan Brahmi, or I share it with the junior monks. So if I get something nice, and I have two of them, you know, I share it out, and you know, even things like sweeties and different bits and pieces which come in, which are offered to the community, and. And you know, like having a sense of humour, like, you know, having fun with your friends. I mean, you don't have to be, you know, sort of like outrageous, but having a sense of humour and being easygoing. And one thing, you know, it's like sort of like criticising. This is one thing I've got to be careful with not to be careful not to sort of like criticise other people, otherwise it creates, you know, big problems really, really quickly. So hi there. Why can't the Buddha statue at the monastery face east like all others? So the way we've actually got the, I'm not a question Achan Brahmi on this one. But the way the hall was set up, the lay of the land and the way they had, you know, they set the building up, with the infrastructure, the way the buildings were orientated, this is one of the reasons why the Buddha Rupa was set up, you know, facing out, you know, towards the sea. And because, you know, they, with the orientation, they had to have the car park in a particular format. With the slope of the land, they had to have the temple in a certain location. You know, with the slope, with the car park access, with the ability to actually move the hall, you know, to build the hall right at the back, and you have the flat ground. You can move right back, but moving down towards Achan Brahmi's his hut location, it starts moving down the slope, so you know, it gets tricky. You know, unless you say Abhayagiri, where they've got, you know, with the property just really slopes in a major way, and they've actually had to, you know, like raise buildings up on. Like on column structures, because the grade just falls away right to the bottom of the property, and the kutis, the main hall. Like, I haven't seen any photographs. It must be on the web, but I've heard it, you know, on and off. And I mean, some of the engineering principles were quite something. You know, just to have these buildings elevated. The notebook with King's photo on the cover was found. It is now pinned on the board in the kitchen hall. Please find the owner. Thank you. Please explain the gradual training and how it applies to us lay disciples. Much metta to Dani and Michelle for looking after us so well. So please explain the gradual training and how it applies with the lay disciples. So the vast majority of you are aware of the foundation principles with the Buddhist teachings. So you know those key points, the five precepts, which you know if you can possibly maintain continually on a day-to-day basis, all well and good, give you a very very high degree of protection in day-to-day life, keeps you out of trouble. It helps maximize your personal happiness. The five precepts is essentially because you've got this this kind of very the precepts protect you. They give you moral protection. They protect you from fear, shame, worry, blame. If you live a blameless life, you haven't got a worry in the world. And you know there are things going on around you. You know you've got other people and their stuff. You may have to deal with their stuff, but within you, you look within you, you've got no problems. Other people around you might have trouble and difficulty, but on your side of things, you're okay. You know, you've got nothing to worry about. So the precepts, you know, that's where the happiness comes in, the joy. You've got a degree of you've got peace of mind. You've got the happiness which comes from like blameless living. You know, a blameless conduct. You can't see anything within yourself where you would actually reproach oneself or anyone else might point the finger and think that you're a dodgy person, because especially if you're a Buddhist practitioner, people tend to watch you much more closely than maybe possibly a Christian or a regular person who's walking the street, because they expect the Buddhist person to be a nice person, to be a good person. And when you're not, they may be on you sort of quite quickly. And then they're moving on with the generosity principle, developing that sense of giving, open-heartedness, reducing one's self-interest, one's selfishness. Whatever one's got, in one's life, you know, within one's material ability, you know, within your financial parameters. If you're a poor person, you know, you could share just very very basic things. You know, you can even like throw breadcrumbs to sparrows in your backyard, or give maybe a dollar to a homeless person, or maybe help a person with a telephone call. They need change for the phone, or this kind of thing. You know, just very very small ways. If you're a poor person, or you know if you're say wealthy, you know there was that story that one of the monks in England, they were staying in a house in one of the local towns in the suburbs outside London, and they saw a businessman on his way to work, you know, in the London business district, with a nice suit and his bowler hat and his cane, and there was a homeless man huddled in a corner of some shop fronts. And he went over. You know, the guy was an alcoholic, and he was dressed in old clothes, and you know he probably hadn't washed, and probably smelled, and he was impoverished, and he could have been mentally disturbed as well, and the fellow, he was well dressed, nice suit, and he went over and he helped the old fellow up, and he took him, you know, he took him away, led him away, and by the arm and took him down to one of the local shops and bought him you know like a like a feed of fish and chips and a cup of tea and maybe a few other little extras. I did that when I was in Thailand. I went Bintapat from in Bangkok. We were staying at Damarun, which is the monks' residence where the Western monks need to stay when they're doing business in Bangkok. And I went Bintapat, and you've got to be pretty fast because, when you walk back, you've got a full bowl, and you've got 4 to 5 shopping bags of foodstuffs, both noodles, fresh fruit, sweets, and you're racing back, and even then people they're giving you stuff. And as I was moving back quite quickly, and I ran at the last corner, there was a boy, maybe about 16, and he was just laying on the slab, in a t-shirt and shorts with no shoes, and I only had a look at him and I could tell he was mentally disturbed, and he was just laying there. So what I did was I just put my bags down and I just whipped out maybe half a shopping bag's worth of stuff, say at least. So there was at least, easily like 1.5, big meals. And then I went down a bit further. I thought, give him at least a full bag, a bag and a half. So I went back and he was curled up in a ball. And then I pulled the stuff out, and then I just sort of tucked it in. I tucked it into his like belly section, so he was actually, as he was rolled up, and I just tucked it into his body, so it was pretty obvious as soon as he opened his eyes because he was sleeping, and I walked away, so at least he would have been okay for the next say 24 hours, maybe day and a half. But he was laying there. And not one person, like on the streets. And I looked around, and there was like, I could see easily like 40 people, and there were noodle bars on both sides of the streets, like further down, maybe about a couple of hundred. Maybe they could see them across the street, but not further down on the left. But nobody bothered. They gave me a full bowl and 5 shopping bags worth of food. And they couldn't even get a bowl of noodles for this kid who was just laying on the slab, So you sort of wonder what's happening. Let's see. Was it Adrian? I noticed I noticed the super monk in the comic strip wore his underpants on the outside. Could you please explain? I'm sorry, I can't explain. But I don't know. Maybe at a guess maybe it's sort of even like physically, maybe it looks a bit more presentable for a bloke or a female to actually have the second layer of garments, on the outside of the body. Because if a person's running around in like a, what would you call it, like a bodysuit, whether you're a male or female, it might look a little bit too racy. So, but if you wear your underpants on the outside, it's a little bit, it might look a little bit more acceptable. And then once you put a cape on them and a pair of boots, maybe they start to look fantastic. But anyway, yes, I hope. It looks like most of you have had a really, really good retreat. You're smiling and joyful. I don't see anyone here who's like really depressed and unhappy. So, sounds like things have gone quite well for you. Was there any other questions before we finished up? Nothing at all. Okay, righto.
I've actually just taken a tick off my body and it's still moving down there.
The easiest way with the ticks is just take it firmly between your thumb and your index finger and twist it. Don't try and pull it. It doesn't work. You twist it, you'll get it off straight away. And then just take him outside and maybe just put him in the garden where he's got a chance of survival. They may not like it. You do, yeah. But that's right. You know, we're moving into the tick season, and they're really starting to pop up. We had one young monk at the Bundanoon Monastery, and I mean, sometimes he was taking off like 15 to 20 ticks on a daily basis. He was living in a cave, and they were all over the. There was like a sandy basin, and they were like all over the floor section as well. Like you had to walk 30 minutes through the forest. And he was like sleeping on a sandy basin, and they were just crawling around there as well. Okay. So what I'll do is I'll pay the last homage to the Buddha, and we'll finish up.